Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and today we have another awesome interview for the UI Audit book, and today Rob Walling is joining us. He's the founder of Drip Software, and we just talked with Derek Kramer, and now we're going to talk to Rob about marketing and how marketing affects UI UX decisions. So hi, Rob. Thank you for coming today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Jane.
Amazing. So we just learned what Drip is actually about, but we would love to hear your version of the story, how Drip got started.
Sure. I was running an app called HitTail, software as a service app. And this was in 2012. And I decided I really wanted to double down on the email list. So I wanted to build it up. And I couldn't find an easy way to add email capture, an email form, to every page of the website. And I didn't want to go in and have to modify HTML. I didn't want to put it in the header, didn't want to put it in the footer. And so I worked with Derek, who was a contractor for me at the time. And we came up with an idea of having this little JavaScript toaster widget pop up. And now they're all over the place, right? You have SumoMe and Optin Monster, and I don't know, there's a lot of them in Drip, of course. But at the time, there was nothing. There was no software that really did this. There were a couple open source libraries. And it wound up taking Derek several days to style this thing and get it up on the site and get it working and getting all the copy written and all that stuff. And it was kind of a fiasco. A lot of time and a lot of effort, especially to get it, you know, wired up in MailChimp and everything. And so I realized that there was probably an opportunity there to build something to make that process easier.
So it was totally a fertile ground there, and it also was scratching your own itch at that time.
Yeah, I did go out and validate it beyond that, because I don't like building things based on one person's opinion, even if, you know, if it's mine. So I went and found 10 people who committed to paying me a monthly fee for it before we started building.
Did they actually pay you those dollars?
Nope, I just got commitments in advance.
Right. And from there to the point where it's now, you've gone a long way through finding that perfect product market fit.
Yep.
And you shared that quite a lot at your recent MicroConf talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love our listeners to know that as well. How did it actually happen? It's not like one day decision. How did you nail down that positioning for marketing automation?
Yeah, it was a pretty long road. I mean, Derek spent about 6 months building. He was first doing it half time because he was working on HitTail. And then I realized that Drip was just such a bigger opportunity that moved him over to full time working on it. And Derek later became my co-founder, by the way. You know, so he started as a contractor, and then we changed that relationship up later on. But in essence, Drip launched as an email marketing platform that did some basic stuff, kind of akin to MailChimp. And what we found was that if we wanted to charge more money than MailChimp or than the typical email provider, then we had to have more advanced features. And it makes sense in retrospect, but we thought we had a differentiated product. We had really good UX and UI interactions. And we had an easy to use system that did the job really well. But a lot of people said this is great software, but it's just not worth what you're charging. And we were charging $49 a month is what I wanted the minimum plan to be. Because I've played around. I've had a lot of apps that are $10, $20, $30 a month, and those apps are hard to grow to the level that I wanted to take this one. And so after getting that feedback, a lot of people would say it's just a little too expensive. You know, I debated, do we drop the price, or do we basically build more advanced features? Like, what features do I need to build to make this work worth $49? And that's where we had a ton of user feedback, and sifting through that is hard. You know, it's a challenge to know what to build. But in essence, I noticed that marketing automation was being brought up, and these automation rules and being able to move people in and out of sequences based on what they do and tagging and all that stuff was a prominent thing. And it seemed like it was kind of a wave that was just starting to crest, you know, just starting to build up. And so that was at the point where we decided to build an automation engine. And as we started deploying that over the course of the next several months, it was obvious that our churn was dropping and our trial to paid conversion rate was going up. And it was that was what was getting us towards product market fit.
So these were the obvious vital signs that you made the right decision.
Yes, because it was not obvious that we had made the right decision. I mean, when you first break ground on this code, I'd asked folks if this is what they wanted, but you know, you have 200 people, 300 people giving you their opinion, and it's hard to figure out what to build. So it was a good couple months of kind of agonizing over which direction do we take this? What are we actually building here? Because we didn't just want to build features. That doesn't help. You have to have some type of vision for you know where you're headed. And when we made the decision, like we are going to become a lower cost, high value marketing automation platform, that was then you instantly know what to build and what not to build. You're not going to build shopping cart software onto it, which some people were requesting. You're not going to build an affiliate management program. You're not going to build landing pages, probably. You're not going to build, you know, the CRM upfront. I mean, there's a bunch of things that you don't need, and then we could really focus on exactly what we needed to build.
Yeah, that's a great approach. And we just talked with Derek about that integrations can actually replace those requests pretty well and keep you focused on that key functionality that you set out to build.
That's right.
So how did those customer interviews look like? Did you, you know, explore their personas? Do you give questionnaires to them, or did you just have free chat?
I did a lot of free chat. And to be honest, it was all via email. I don't know that I had any. Actually, I had a couple in person at MicroConfs at Europe, MicroConf Europe a couple years ago, where some people specifically said, have you thought about building something that's way easier to use than Infusionsoft, maybe a little less expensive, but that does, you know, 70-80% of what it does. And I got into several conversations in person, and I was trying to wrap my head around what that even meant, you know, what parts of Infusionsoft and, why is it so hard to use and what do you not like about it and how expensive is it? And just getting into that world, I wasn't in that world yet. And so there was a lot of education. But that was just me grilling someone, you know, and like literally taking notes. I'm on break at MicroConf. I'm running the conference thinking about who's going to speak next, but I started taking kind of customer development notes at this point. I mean, we're already live and doing 8-9,000 a month in revenue, somewhere between 7 and 9. I don't remember what it was, but, and yet we're like, we need to do customer development for this next phase to figure out what folks want. And then I did a lot of interviews via email where I reached out to folks who I trusted. I mean, I had the luxury of that, right? Of having people who were using Drip who I knew well enough to know that they would give me decent advice and they were smart and that it wasn't just these unknown people who weren't going to take the time to give me feedback. It was not an overwhelming majority. It wasn't like, boy, 90% of people said you should go into marketing automation. It was not like that at all. There was a lot of signal, there was a lot of noise, and in sifting through it, it was kind of like, okay, so the first step is to build some automation stuff. The second part was figuring out, what do we call ourselves now? You know, are we email marketing? Are we something more like Intercom or customer.io or Xero Vero, who's, you know, there's all these things you can be in the email space. And I didn't even know what we were to be called at that point. And that became a whole other search to find the label, you know, of what position we were in.
Yes. Did you do research to find actual words?
Absolutely. Yeah. I was all over the email space looking at all the folks I just named plus 20 or 30 other email marketing companies just to figure out, like, were we still email marketing? Had we become customer-centric email marketing? Had we become marketing automation? I didn't really know what marketing automation was, but as I dove into it, I realized, oh, email is at the center of marketing automation. And so, although we hadn't, you know, marketing automation typically includes this email marketing piece, there's CRM, there's lead scoring, there's a couple other pieces to it. And we had built like 3 of the 6 or 4 of the 6. And so that's when I realized, oh, we actually are pretty close to marketing automation, even though I don't want Drip to be that, or I didn't want Drip to be that, because it just feels really enterprise-y. You know, it felt kind of like a market we didn't really want to be in. I kind of wanted to stay nimble and be a startup and do all that fun stuff and be able to call ourselves something fun, whereas marketing automation feels stodgy and enterprise-y. But I realized that is actually what we were becoming. And that market was ripe for someone to kind of come in with good UX and UI and a slightly lower price point there was nobody in the space. There was this big gap. And it's kind of the, you know, being above MailChimp and AWeber in terms of, and Constant Contact and, you know, all the basic email marketing platforms, being above them in terms of price and in terms of power and automatability and all this crazy stuff you can do. And then in terms of price and UX being, well, in terms of price being below like Infusionsoft, Pardot, Marketo, but tried to be better UX, because that was the main complaint I kept hearing, or Derek and I kept hearing, was that these big enterprise tools are so cumbersome. They're so hard to use. They're so hard to get started. So that was something from the start, is like, this is our differentiator. You know, it's that we want to be in this space, but we are the lightweight version and we're easier to use than the other tools you've tried.
And you did achieve great success with that. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, that was absolutely the turning point for the app. I mean, then things shot up, you know, revenue started growing very quickly at that point. And now we're at, I think, well, we'll be at 6 employees here in the next month or so.
That's great. Congratulations again. So as of today, does it feel like you have a truly mature product, or do you have like a big plan on expansion and feature growth?
I'd say both, to be honest. I mean, you know, the Drip is very mature in terms of how much it can do and the core value proposition of being able to manage your email and handle all the automations you need, moving people in and out of lists based on clicks, very advanced stuff. I mean, we've basically spent several man years, because we had 3 people working on it full time for quite a long time, 3 developers. Mm-hmm. We've cranked out a ton of features. At the same time, there are things on the periphery that I think we're still, or I know, I mean, we're still in discussion about adding on, you know, adding on whole new areas like a visual builder. And, you know, we always have this discussion, should we build CRM into this or not? And that would be a whole new kind of piece to add on to it.
Mm-hmm. What is your long-term plan? Like, let's say 5 years of mm-hmm. Drip. How do you see that?
You know, it's funny. I don't make long-term plans because, I mean, I know the long-term plan is growth. You know, it's to get big, not in terms of headcount, but just to keep revenue growing. But in terms of like feature roadmap and that kind of stuff, we plan maybe 3 months out. I mean, I think I have a loose game plan of what the next 6 months might look like, but things just change too frequently in this space. Especially, we're in a pretty crowded space. It's very competitive. And so we're keeping our eye on what other folks are doing and what our customers are asking. And we will, you know, we have priorities certainly in our issue tracker, but I can't even imagine what we'll be building in 12 months, much less 5 years down the road.
All right. Do you plan to build like a suite of applications or just focusing on Drip?
Oh, focused on Drip. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think if we were to add, let's say we were to add CRM, you know, or add something that is not necessarily core to email marketing, it'd still be within Drip, but it would be probably a separate kind of price module that you'd add on. And it would be so that if you didn't need CRM, that it wouldn't bother you in the UI, right? We're not going to add it. We're not going to embed it into the app so that everybody who wants to do email also has to look at CRM. So it would be under the same umbrella and under the same code base. But we would separate it out enough that folks who don't need that functionality wouldn't be bothered by it.
By the way, I'm really impressed by actual brand name you picked for your product. How did you nail that down so easily that it's called Drip for Drip marketing?
We agonized over it. Holy, I have a list of potential names that, like 50 different names, including like such bad stuff, you know, like Velvet Mail was one I was going to do. Courier, getcourier.com, I think was available at the time. And Courier is a cool name because it's, you know, delivering email and delivering stuff, but it's hard to spell. It's hard to spell, I think, is the biggest issue. And we were debating it, and I was discussing it with Jason Roberts from the TechZing podcast. And he and I were hanging out in Pasadena. And we were actually eating lunch, and he went to the bathroom and he came back and he said, I have the name of your app. It should be called Drip. And I was like, that's genius, you know? And he said, you name the generic is what he said. Cause Drip marketing is now, it's funny how common it is and how much we hear people talking about it now, but it was like just that phrase was just kind of coming to the forefront. You know, people were not talking about it nearly as much as they are today. And so it was a really really cool name. I knew it right away when he said it. And then he went on and searched and found that getdrip.com, a 7-letter domain name, was available, you know, via registrar. So it was a big win. I actually was punching, I was on my phone and like downloaded the GoDaddy app because we were at a playground with our kids, and I downloaded the GoDaddy app, and then I couldn't remember my password, and I had to reset my password, and I was really furious because he had searched for it, and I knew that that meant, you know, once you search for it, there's a potential that someone within the company will go buy it. Like sometimes you'll get domains swiped from you, and so I really wanted to buy this thing now, and so I was in a big hurry, and I registered it, you know, within an hour of him doing his initial search. I bought it from my iPhone in the middle of a playground.
Yeah, that's a real success story.
Yeah,
congratulations.
Thank you.
So. So these days, now that the product is more stable, how often do you do customer interviews, and how do you plan on features, and how do you sift through those requests daily?
Yeah, I only do customer interviews as needed when we have questions about features that we're building, because the number of features that are in our queue, I mean, there's probably a couple hundred, you know, that are in the feature request. The tracking, the issue tracking we're using, it's called CodeTree, and it sits over GitHub issues. And when we come to an issue that I feel like we need customer input on, I will either call someone or email them, because I know our customers well enough at this point that I know someone who will really want to use it. And either someone has requested it, or I'll know someone who will think it's a great feature, and then I'll go ask them. But the nice part is that we are such avid users of our own software that just within the office, we have a decent idea about how features should work. Because if you think about it, you know, not only are we using Drip for Drip, we use it for Hittail. I use it for Software by Rob, my blog. So I have that use case of kind of the blogger I'm an author as well, right? I have a book. And so that use case is there. I run MicroConf, so we have the conference use case. I have a podcast called Startups for the Rest of Us, so we have the podcast use case. You know, I have a real myriad of different use cases, and it's only if I need to go, we have some folks who are like brick and mortars or who are coaches or consultants. It's if we go outside of kind of our areas that I tend to, you know, get on the phone and interview someone.
Mm-hmm. By the way, how focused are you on a certain persona for your marketing, or do you like target those niches that you just mentioned, which are much wider?
We tend to target verticals. Yeah, they, you know, there's really good use cases for any type of SaaS or software sellers, companies to use Drip. SaaS and software is a big one. Info marketers / authors / professional bloggers, you know, kind of that market, folks who are selling digital products online in essence, is another big one. And then consultants and agencies is the third, and then WordPress developers. And so those are our, I mean, that's as persona as we get, because to be honest, if you were to ask me for a persona of each of those, I would probably name a real person, because we have, you know what I'm saying? Because I know our customers so well,
right?
Because we see them I see them twice a year at MicroConf, and we're hanging out on Twitter together. You know, I mean, we're on podcasts together. Like we don't have like, you know, the traditional, have a piece of paper with, you know, a generic name and kind of a description of who they are. And maybe if, you know, as we bring new people on, we will need that, because they don't know the folks like Derek and I and the rest of the team do.
Right. By the way, it's really great that you mentioned using Drip by yourself, because I'm quite sure that plenty of founders don't actually boil down to, they don't sit down and use it daily, which really brings a wall between the user and the builder.
I agree. I mean, I know that I've had products that I don't use daily. You know, I've owned several of them, and the usability definitely is not as good as Drip. I mean, the fact that I'm in Drip every day, I notice little tiny things that may not bother other people, and we get those fixed, and it keeps the product really, you know, operating kind of at a high, you know, just at an optimum rate, I think, keeps the UX and UI up. And then it also gives you the mindset of what your customers are hopefully thinking. And what is interesting is we'll get feature requests that, you know, we've never thought of internally. And the biggest thing when we do get these feature requests is to come back to the customer and say, thanks for this. What is your use case? asking them for their use case and how they're going to use it is probably the number one piece of advice I would give to someone trying to decide what to build. Because your customers don't tend to know software as well as you do. And so if they suggest features, the odds are that is not actually the feature you should build. What you really want to do is get at the problem that they are trying to solve by asking for that feature, and then you decide, you know, what you should actually build into the product. And that's how you're going to keep that level of UX, of usability high, as if you're really gating the stuff and being in charge of what's being built.
Right. So you consider Drip being an opinionated piece of software?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Well, it's because, I mean, Derek and I wrote quite opinionated about the software we use, you know, and when we use crummy software, it's frustrating. And so we definitely have high standards for anything we use and how it looks and how it feels. And so we have a lot of opinions, and we do get feature requests that we just say outright, no, we will absolutely not build that. That is just not on the roadmap. And if you need that, you'd need to go, find an app that does it. And we typically recommend someone.
You're just lucky to be so confident about that, because I'm sure plenty of founders are just so hesitant about this direction to go.
Yeah, I think it helps. Now that we're almost 3 years in from the day we broke ground on the code, and so you gain confidence in this over time, of especially as, you know, as hundreds and then thousands of people start paying you to use the app and rave about how good it is, then you're like, okay, we've built something people want at this point. And so our vision is coming to fruition here, and we can trust our instincts because we just have 3 years of that knowledge. You have it in your head, you know, of the vision and the direction it should go. And you know that what you've done so far is working. And so you gain confidence that the decisions you're making are working out. And so I think at the start, we had there was a lot more discussion and agonizing over what should we build, what are we building, what's the best direction to take it. In fact, we documented all this in an audio documentary. It's about 90 minutes long, maybe 2 hours. It's at startupstoriespodcast.com. And it's basically, it was recorded over a course of 9 months, and then I edited it way down, but it's just these weekly phone calls that Derek and I were having discussing Drip. And there are multiple times during that 2 hours that are pretty agonizing for me to hear, because we were just so indecisive and kind of not knowing which way to go.
Is there any, you know, quantity, not quality, way of, telling which features are good or which are not? Like, any objective filter you can apply?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's a, I don't know of a, of like a numeric way to do it. I've heard of, I think as a product, it's more mature. You can have your team, I've heard of folks doing kind of a marketplace idea where, you know, let's say you have a team of 4 or 5 people, you come to the whiteboard and you write, hey, these are, you know, we're trying to plan the next 3 months, here are 20 features, and everyone gets a certain amount of votes. You know, almost like a user voice thing where it's like you get 8 votes total and you can put a maximum of 3 on any one thing. I've heard of folks doing that. And that'd be a fairly quantitative way to get, at least within your team, you know, a ranking of what you should build. We've never done that because we don't do a 3-month block. We really build, we deploy multiple times per day. We are rolling multiple, many, many features per week. Some are really small, some are larger. And so it's kind of a really fluid ongoing process. So we use less of a numeric way, and we use more of a, it's more of a filter, where the first question is, does this fit with our vision of the product, right? As founders, does this fit with what we want to build? The second one is, do we think at least 90% of the customers, I'm sorry, not 90, do we think at least 20% is what I meant to say, at least 20% of the people who are currently using Drip, do we think that they would use this feature? And it's, at that point, it's just a best guess. Because if it's less than 20, if you're going to get 5% of people, we don't like to clutter the product. And so we'll actually gate it behind like a checkbox in the admin area. And we have a couple features that are in Drip, but no one can see them unless you request them.
I know about it. I just heard that from Derek. Yep. This is spectacular.
Yeah. And it's to keep the product simpler, you know? I mean, some features people can easily hurt themselves with because they're fairly advanced. And other ones just clutter the UI to the point where, you know, we didn't want that to happen. So we've used multiple, there's a lot of filters and a lot of questions that we ask. And it is based on, there's a little bit of intuition and a little bit of gut feeling, which is a bummer. You know, I wish it could be more numeric, but that's kind of how we do it when we're moving this fast. I think that's the best way we found.
All right. These are some really good questions to filter that out. Actually, this should be put on big board above your head in the office or something like that.
Yep, I agree.
So in your product portfolio, Drip is certainly not the first. Mm-hmm. And how was your product line? How did it look like before Drip? And how has your experience affect the way that you build things these days as opposed to your early products?
Yeah. I kind of have two sides to the stuff that I own, the products. I mean, there's the personal brand side, which is my blog, podcast, conference, the book, and Micropreneur Academy, which is an online membership website. And then there's the software side. And I've owned things ranging from e-commerce websites to productized consulting services. Most recently, I think as of, let's say, 3 years ago when we started Drip, I owned Hittail, which is a SaaS app. It's a long tail keyword tool. I owned .NET Invoice, which is one-time sale, downloadable invoicing software. It's web-based software you download. I owned Wedding Toolbox, which allowed people to build wedding websites. And there's one other, Apprentice Lineman Jobs, which is a niche job board for electricians. I have since sold or shut down or given away all of them. And the only thing I own today is Hittail and Drip in terms of software. And the reason I've done that is because Drip, it's just a bigger, you know, when you start growing in 1 month more revenue than all of your other products are making or than any individual product is making and you're growing that fast, it's like it doesn't make sense to hold on to that thing. So .NET Invoice was a partnership and I just gave it to the other partner. And the other ones I sold or shut down, as I said. None of those other, and then, you know, to get to the second part of your question, which was how do I build software today compared to what I used to do? I think that, you know, the stakes are higher with Drip because Drip is a much larger, more ambitious effort than anything I've done. I've tended to want to 10x my previous 5 or 10x my previous efforts. So early on, something was making 1,000 a month. And then I said, well, what can I do to make 5,000 a month? And then, actually my next step was up to about 25,000 a month. So that was, I guess more of a 5x thing. And then the question after Hittail was to say, what's 5 or 10x this size? And certainly going into marketing automation space, there's room to do that. And given the growth, I think we're on trajectory. So since the stakes are higher, we're definitely, this is the most complex piece of software, most complex app I've owned. And it's also, I think, the one that I'm focusing on now. You know, in the past, I've had multiple apps at once and balanced everything. And that's really going away these days. I think when you're building something this big in a space this competitive, it should be all you're focused on. And that's how it's different, you know, is that basically I'm all in on this. Aside from still running the microconfs and doing a podcast, this is really all that I'm working on. I'm not spending time on Hittail, and I don't have any other apps anymore.
Right. So keeping focused, staying focused is one more important thing that we should keep in mind.
I agree. Yeah. I think entrepreneurs it's a very common mistake to make, you know, to try to do too many things at once. And to start two things at once is a terrible idea. I see folks trying to launch two apps. It's just way, way too time intensive.
So with Drip, you've been lucky enough to have Derek, who is, you know, jack of all trades, who is mm-hmm. handling the whole cycle. But have you had experience with a different, you know, separately designers, developers
oh,
in
sure.
the past?
Absolutely.
So some input on that?
Yeah, I mean, you just have to become a project manager and you have to fill in the gaps. I mean, luckily, you know, I would have a designer design something and then I'd have someone slice it and put in HTML, CSS. And since I'm not a designer for sure, but I know enough about HTML, CSS that if there was something jacked up, I could help with it or fix it. Then I would have a developer, you know, put the code behind it. And luckily, if that got screwed up or that needed maintenance or anything like that, I could fix that. I know PHP and .NET and, you know, Perl and a bunch of other stuff. So I think that becoming the project manager and allowing, you know, and just keeping folks motivated and being able to QA their work, I think is really important. I think the more you know about what your contractors or, you know, employees, as the case may be, the more you know about what they're doing in terms of technically, I think by far the better off you are. You don't need to become a production developer or a production ready designer or production ready, you know, front end developer, but being able to sanity check things and dig into it a little bit and even make some changes here and there, I think is important, especially if you're working with several contractors who are not necessarily affiliated and you're passing stuff between them. There are going to be things that fall through the cracks. And so you either need to fix those, or tweak them yourself last minute, or, you know, have someone that you can call on and help you on short notice.
Yes. Once again, technical background can be incredibly great.
Yeah.
This is a weird place to ask, but could you share some biography facts of yours? Like, what life have you gone through to become such an effective product owner?
Well, I mean, I'm a software developer by trade. I started writing code when I was 8 years old on my Apple IIe, learned BASIC, and then, you know, built text-based games back when Zork was big. And I graduated from college in the late 90s, and it was during the dot-com boom, and I lived in the Bay Area. And so anybody with a pulse could get a job coding. And so I became worked for a consulting firm who's building dot-com websites. And so I, within the course of about 2 years, I had to learn, I think, six different web programming languages, just because whatever the client needed, that's what I did. So I did PHP and Perl, ASP, Cold Fusion, Java, and then landed on .NET.
This is impressive.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, I'm not an expert in all of them, but I built production websites with each of those languages, built or modified for sure. So that was it. And then, you know, there was the big .com crash. And so I did a lot of consulting over the next 6-7 years, both in kind of high level technology stuff, but I did a lot of coding, a lot of C#, VB.NET, some PHP, and slowly tried to improve my, you know, front end skills, and then started launching products, really in the early 2000s, and had my first moderate success that did a couple $1,000s a month in 2005 with .NET Invoice. And then since then launched or acquired a bunch of different small web properties, and I quit consulting altogether around, I think it was 2007, 2008, where I had enough income from products that I was done for life, you know, in terms of doing the consulting stuff. And now I'm, like I said, from there, I then tried to level up each time, you know, build something a little more ambitious, not just for ambition's sake, but really because it keeps me interested, right? I think a lot of us are lifelong learners and perpetual learners, and that's what we thrive on, and that's what success is to me, is to be able to work on what I want and to be able to learn however much, you know, that I can feed my brain, because that's when I'm happiest.
Absolutely. That's one of my credos as well. It's great to keep learning in different areas. So business and marketing skills are self-taught. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't go to school, just by, you know, a lot of trial and error, a lot of reading, obviously. And I mean, I was learning online marketing probably starting in 2004. So there were really no podcasts on it. I was actually there was no startup marketing space, right? Now there's like people who are building courses for startups on how to market, and software products and stuff. There really wasn't much then. So I read a lot of Joel Spolsky. I read Eric Sink, which had some of that, but I also borrowed a lot from kind of the direct marketers and the information marketers, like let's say a Dan Kennedy or, Frank Kern and those guys. But I took what I liked out of it. I mean, I don't agree with a lot of the stuff. I feel like they go a little too over the top, and it feels a little ethically dubious at times. And so I tried to take the lessons that they were teaching and then put my own spin on them and make them feel more comfortable with my personality, you know, and my approach, the approach I want to have to business.
Right. So having seeing so many things come and go, do you have some kind of sense for those emerging opportunities, emerging new markets or new trends? Is there any verbal criteria you can define?
Do you mean like marketing approaches that are working better?
Like in general, for example, with Drip, it was clear that the marketing niche was empty at that point,
right.
And you just nailed that entry point into that niche. And
right.
how can other people spot those emerging markets right now?
Oh boy, that's a tough question because we didn't even see it until we launched and had an app in production, people paying us, then saying, I really want it to do that. So it's almost like, I think it comes back to something I've said for years, which is do things in public. And by that, I mean, publish a blog, write a book, do a podcast, throw a conference or even a meetup, launch an app, even if it's open source, get stuff out there. Because as soon as you start doing that, that's when people will start to comment on it. They'll say, oh, that's great, but could it do this? Or they'll say, oh, this is a great opportunity. Can I hire you to help me with that? As soon as you start doing things in public, A, you start getting over the fear of doing things in public, which is a really big deterrent for all of us. And B, that's when things start to happen and that's when the opportunities arise. And I think that standing on the sidelines and reading TechCrunch and VentureBeat and Inc. magazine, you're not going to see anything that other people aren't hearing about as well. And that's not where the opportunities are. The opportunities are when your feet are stuck in the quicksand and you're the only one there and you're the one trying to figure out where to go from there. But you're getting this proprietary input because if you've launched an open source project or you've started a software app, people giving you feedback and suggestions on that, they can be invaluable, right? They can be gold, which obviously was the case in our situation because it helped us move into marketing automation. But no one else was hearing those because it wasn't written in some VentureBeat article. It was sent directly to us because we were the ones that had taken the risk to launch the product. So I think that would probably be my piece of advice is to do things in public and that'll get you on your way.
This is great. I was going to ask for some piece of advice, but this is just it.
That would be it.
Any other piece of advice in regards of building things, like how to make it as painless as possible?
I think learning to outsource is a big one that a lot of us don't want to do, especially if you are a full stack developer or someone who can do multiple things, who can design and do front-end work and do back server-side work and write copy and all that stuff. I think learning to let some of that go is a piece of advice I would give to people. Every entrepreneur or developer or designer I've spoken to who has launched a product and needed to support it long-term, everyone I've talked to who I eventually convinced to outsource some part of it, whether it's, excuse me, whether it's support or whether it's some of the front end work or some of the back end work, I've never heard them regret it in the long term. Maybe in the short term, there's some stumblings of trying to find that person to help you and saying, well, they can never do it as good as I can. Or, well, I only spend 1 to 2 hours a week on it. It's not worth outsourcing. I mean, these are all the typical things that go through our head. But as soon as you are able to let that go, you are able to focus on the things that really matter to your business and your business is going to grow faster.
This is amazing. Thank you.
Yep.
Do you consider yourself a perfectionist or not?
In general, yes. I've had to let some of that go. I think it's funny, being a perfectionist is, I'm just a very detail-oriented person, so I see when there's things that are not right, especially, when you're a software developer, especially like you are looking for things that are wrong because that helps you debug your code and it helps you have code that doesn't crash with edge cases. So I've always been that very meticulous kind of find all the things that are wrong with things. With that said, I've realized that if I have someone, someone on my team do something, I may be a perfectionist in the fact that I want it done, a certain way, but they might do it in a way that doesn't match up with that, but it doesn't mean that it's not as good. I mean, if there's a glaring mm-hmm. error, there's a copy that's cumbersome, or there's a more elegant way to do it, we'll talk about it. But I found that people will come up with, especially if you have good people, they'll come up with ideas and ways to do things that are different than what you expected. But they're often as good or better, even though early days of doing this, when I was just getting started, if it was anywhere different than what I had envisioned, then it was quote unquote wrong, And I think getting mm-hmm. over that is probably a big win.
Right. So Rob, I think this is all I have for you today, and your advice has been amazing. I'm sure all our listeners will take away so much and try to apply it.
Yep.
So tell us a few links where people can find you online.
Sure. If you like consuming audio content, I put out a 30-minute podcast every week, and we've done it for 5 years straight, and it's talking all about this kind of stuff. It's about marketing. It's about launching products. It's called Startups for the Rest of Us, and you can search for us in iTunes or go to startupsfortherestofus.com. And then on Twitter, I'm at Rob Walling.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for coming today. I'm sure it was great, and I hope you just conquer all the best heights with Drip further on.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I also wanted to give folks a special, like a coupon code for Drip.
Oh, great.
So,
great. Let's do that.
Add that into the show notes. Basically, I just want to give folks, normally we have a 21-day trial, but if anyone's interested in upping their email marketing game and checking out the UI that we've been talking about here for 40 minutes. We'll include that in the show notes, and it'll double their trial. So give folks a full 6 weeks to check it out.
Yeah, there will be a special document with show notes to each interview, and it's going to be there. So
sounds great.
Awesome. Thank you, Rob.
Thanks, Jen.